Welcome to the Skeptic's Guide to Emergency Medicine. Meet him, greet him, treat him, and street him. Today's date is November 13th, 2019, and I'm your skeptical host, Ken Milne. The title of today's podcast is In the Pregnant Years, Diagnosing Pulmonary Embolisms. And our guest skeptic is Dr. Teresa Robertson. She is an emergency physician practicing at the Peterborough Regional Health Center. She's also an adjunct professor and on faculty at Queen's University, Department of Family Medicine. Welcome to the SGM, Teresa.
Thank you, Ken. I'm glad to be here.
Why don't you tell us where we're recording this today?
So we are in one of our local churches here in Peterborough at our conference that we hold annually. It's a lot of fun. It's a good time for us to meet together and have excellent guests like yourselves, keep us up to date on emergency medicine topics.
And we have some amazing faculty for this year's KEMC. So who are they? I will introduce one of my favorite, Diane Boombaumer. Hello, Dr. Boombaumer. She is a fabulous educator. Do you want to introduce anybody?
Sure, I'll introduce Connie LeBlanc from Halifax.
Dr. LeBron's in the house. Who else?
We also have Aaron Thiel from North York General. Where is Aaron? There he is.
Do we have anybody else? I think that's it, isn't it?
That's it from this morning, so we'll stay tuned for this afternoon.
Yeah, you've got to be here for this afternoon. All right, well, we start each podcast with a case to try to frame the conversation about the paper we're going to be discussing. So, give us a case.
All right. This is a case of a 32-year-old female, G1P0, who is 22 weeks pregnant, and she presents to your local emergency department with the chief complaint of shortness of breath. She states that for the last 1 week, she's had progressive shortness of breath on exertion. She denies any chest pain, fever, cough, or leg swelling. She has no history of venous thromboembolic disease like DVT or PE. But she recently drove 7 hours from London, Ontario to Montreal, Quebec. She is worried about the possibility of a PE. She is otherwise healthy, takes only prenatal vitamins, and has no allergies. She is terrified about any radiation exposure in pregnancy, and has read on Google that there's a blood test you can order to rule out PE.
We often get patients that consult Dr. Google, but I did notice that you said it took 7 hours to go from London, Ontario to Montreal. You know how long it took me to go from London, Ontario to Peterborough last night? Yeah, about 7 hours. A bit of a whiteout. Anyways, we've covered VTE, or venous thromboembolism, a number of times on the SGM. And this has even included a few episodes with the PE guru and PERC rule creator, Dr. Jeff Klein. However, we've never looked at the years criteria study published in The Lancet back in 2017.
So let's first talk about the years algorithm. So the years algorithm starts with the clinician suspecting an acute PE. Then they order a D-dimer test, and you apply the years criteria. It has three items, and each gets 1 point. There's a point for clinical signs of a DVT, hemoptysis, and PE being the most likely diagnosis.
And if there is 0 years items and the D-dimer is less than 1,000, then a PE is excluded. If there is 0 years items and the D-dimer is equal to or greater than 1,000, then we need to get a CT pulmonary angiography, or CTPA, scan as needed to rule out the PE.
And if there's one or more years items, or like what I'd like to call a years positive, and the D-dimer is less than 500, then a PE is excluded. If the years is positive because there's one or more items that are detected, then the D-dimer is equal to, if it's equal to or greater than 500, then a CT scan is needed to rule out the PE.
Everybody listening knows that you're Canadian because when you stumbled, you said sorry.
Sorry. It's very true.
It's like this monosynaptic reflex that we can't suppress. Oh, sorry about that. So, while this publication was interesting, it was a prospective observational study from the Netherlands. There was a study in AEM in 2018 that was done in 17 hospitals in the US, and they compared usual care for possible PE versus the years criteria. And they enrolled about 1,800 patients, and 84 of them, so that's only 4%, had a PE. And using the standard D-dimer criteria, just over half of them would not have been imaged, but doing that would have missed 2 patients with a PE. Now, years, if you use that, avoided imaging in 2/3 of patients, but 6 would have been missed. So when they looked at the standard care it had a sensitivity of about 98% versus 93% for years. It would be better if there was some randomized control trial comparing usual care to years. In addition, the case that you presented was of a pregnant woman, and the original year's study from 2017 said pregnancy was an exclusion. But actually, I've got an update. When I dove into this article, it actually referred back. And yes, in that 2017, it says pregnant women were excluded. And in this article that we're going to review today, they said back in 2017, pregnancy was not an exclusion. They just didn't have very many people enroll who were pregnant.
Interesting, Ken. So clinically, it can be quite difficult to diagnose a PE in pregnancy because of the overlap of symptoms. And having recently been pregnant, I can definitely tell you this is true.
Are you going to share your N of 1?
Yes.
Did you have cankles?
I did not have cankles, but definitely shortness of breath and some tachycardia, which, you know, are the signs and symptoms of PE.
It's amazing when you're carrying around and growing another human being, you know, every day, and it's growing and it's getting bigger and bigger. And it's like carrying around a 20 or 30 pound knapsack. It could make you short of breath.
It definitely does. And the incidence of PE is reported to be 1.72 cases per 1,000 deliveries, and it accounts for approximately one death in every 100,000 deliveries.
In addition, the diagnostic tests used to diagnose PE come with their own risks to both the mom and the fetus. The radiation to the maternal breast can be potentially carcinogenic, owing to the radiosensitive nature of the glandular breast tissue during pregnancy. A CTPA study can increase the risk of breast cancer by 1.5% in a 25-year-old woman. Wow.
Mm-hmm.
All right, so you got to give us a clinical question.
All right, so our clinical question, can the YERS algorithm, which utilizes the D-dimer test, be used in pregnant women to rule out the diagnosis of PE?
And what's the reference?
It's Vanderpoel et al., Pregnancy Adapted YERS Algorithm for Diagnosis of Suspected PE, which was published in the New England Journal of Medicine in 2019.
And I mentioned being Canadian earlier, where we say sorry all the time. The way I describe the New England Journal of Medicine, it's not my favorite journal. I'm not going to say anything bad about it, but it's not my favorite journal. All right, let's run through the PICO. What was the population that was involved in this study?
So the population was pregnant women 18 years of age and older with clinically suspected PE, which they defined as new onset or worsening dyspnea, plus or minus hemoptysis or tachycardia, who were referred to the emergency department or the obstetrical ward.
And then they did have some exclusions. If you were treated with a full dose of therapeutic anticoagulation agent, can't attend follow-up, you had an allergy to contrast dye, or a life expectancy of less than 3 months. All right, what was the intervention?
So the intervention was the application of the pregnancy-adapted YERS algorithm to rule out PE in pregnant women.
And what did they compare it to?
Well, it was a hypothetical situation in which all patients undergo a CT scan or a VQ scan.
All right, and then they had outcomes. What was their primary outcome? And primary means one.
So the primary outcome was the cumulative incidence of symptomatic VTE with confirmation by objective tests during a 3-month follow-up period in the subgroup that anticoagulation treatment was withheld.
So what she's saying there is that there was a group of patients that were not anticoagulated, but they wanted to see if any of them would develop a symptomatic venothrombose embolism. What were the secondary outcomes?
The proportion of patients in which CTPA was not indicated.
All right, so you explained the YERS criteria to start with, but how did they modify it for the pregnancy-adapted YERS criteria?
So basically, if the patient had a symptomatic DVT, they would receive an ultrasound on that leg. And if there was a DVT, then they would receive anticoagulation. If they didn't have any symptoms of a DVT, they went straight into the regular YERS algorithm.
Yeah, so if it looked like they had a DVT, they wouldn't go and do a PE study or D-dimers. They'd scan the legs, right?
Exactly.
And if the leg showed that there was a clot, they would say, listen, if there's a clot there and they're presenting with shortness of breath, there's probably a clot upstairs. But either way, it doesn't really matter because the treatment, the anticoagulation treatment's the same. But if they don't identify a clot in the leg, then that's when you get into the standard YERS algorithm. Is that correct?
You've got it.
Whew. All right. So the author's conclusions were pulmonary embolism was safely ruled out by the pregnancy-adapted YERS diagnostic algorithm across all 3 trimesters of pregnancy. CT pulmonary angiography was avoided in between 32 and 65% of patients. Well, the next step in a quality assessment is to do a checklist to probe the literature for its validity. So we've got these quality indicators for various studies. So in this case, there are 9. So we're going to go to 9, not 10. 11's way off. Thou shalt only count to 8 if it's followed. No, I'm getting into Monty Python now. Okay, so quality checklist for clinical decision tools. The study population, did it include or focus on patients in the emergency department?
Well, I'm going to say unsure for this one. The study population included women from 18 different hospitals who were referred to both the emergency department and obstetrical wards for assessment of PE. The study does not indicate what proportion of patients were assessed in which setting. However, I'm not entirely sure how important that point is, as in our hospital, many women over 23 weeks with new complaints of shortness of breath or swelling would be assessed in the obstetrical ward.
They go upstairs.
And not in the emergency department.
Same in places I've worked, whereas if they're over a certain number of weeks, they just go straight to L&D, and we don't evaluate them in the emergency department first, right?
That's
but if
correct.
They're under that age group or that weeks of gestation, then we take care of them first. Mm-hmm. All right, so number 2 is the patients. Did they represent those that had the problem?
I'm going to say yes to this one. All patients were pregnant and presented with clinical features concerning for a PE.
And were all important predictive variables and outcomes, they were explicitly specified.
I also am going to say yes. Predictor variables included were age, duration and trimester of pregnancy, first pregnancy, risk factors like air travel, surgery, immobilization, smoker, previous VTE, no thrombophilia, duration of reported symptoms as well. And outcomes were also explicitly specified.
So the fourth question is this a prospective multi-center study including a broad spectrum of patients and clinicians, i.e. a level 2 study?
Yes, patients were recruited from 18 hospitals, 11 academic and 7 non-academic, and included ED and OB physicians.
I'm starting to feel like you're just the yes woman.
I know.
Okay, let me ask you this question, okay? So clinicians interpreted individual predictor variables and scored the clinical decision rule reliably and accurately.
No.
Yeah, we got one.
So physicians actually may have been aware of the D-dimer results while assessing the year's criteria.
All right, well, is this an impact analysis of a previously validated clinical decision instrument?
No.
Oh, I'm starting to send a new trend. Okay. For level 1 studies, the impact on clinician behavior and patient-centric outcomes is reported.
Also a no.
I got to get you back to yes. Okay, the follow-up. Was it sufficiently long enough and complete?
I think so, yes. Patients were followed for 3 months, and I think this is a reasonable follow-up duration since most women would either no longer be pregnant or, given the natural history of PE, would present much more symptomatically during that time.
They'd be no longer pregnant.
They would be no longer pregnant.
All right. So 9, this is the final question. The effect size was large enough and precise enough to be clinically significant?
I'm a bit unsure. They reported less than 1% incidence of missed VTE. However, there were a number of potential biases that make me less confident about the results being clinically significant.
All right, so we're going to go through the results. They recruited almost 500 pregnant women with clinically suspected PE and enrolled them in the study. The mean age was about 30 years of age, and almost half of them were in their third trimester. Half of the patients had no years criteria. You'd call that years negative. And
yeah, years negative or years positive.
And the other half would have been?
Years positive.
Years positive, yep. Yeah. Math, they told me there'd be no math. All right, and at least one criteria. So 19% had signs of a DVT, 8% had hemoptysis, and 89% PEs were the most likely diagnosis. And the reason that adds up to more than 100% is because you could have more than one of those three criteria, right?
That's correct.
All right. So what was the key result?
So the key result was only one symptomatic DVT was diagnosed in follow-up that was not anticoagulated.
Oh, you got to say that again. I mean, how many patients were missed and not anticoagulated?
Just one.
All right. So let's drill down into that a little bit more. The VTE was at 3 months. That's what they were looking for their primary outcome. And in this subgroup that was not anticoagulated, it was withheld. Give us a few more details.
So that means that 96% of VTE was ruled out at baseline, and only one DVT was identified during follow-up.
All right. Well, the secondary outcome was the proportion of patients in whom a CTPA was not indicated.
So 195 patients were ruled out based on the adapted years algorithm.
And 12 patients in the whole cohort, 12, that represents about 6% of the patients, had a CTPA, even though it was not indicated. In other words, they were protocol violators. Well, the patients weren't protocol violators, but it was a protocol violation to get that. And in all 12 cases that they actually went ahead and got the PE study done, none of the patients had a PE.
So CTPA could safely be avoided in 39% of patients.
This is my favorite part of the show, because you know what we get to do?
Get to talk nerdy.
Talk nerdy to me, Teresa. Okay, so here, I love talking nerdy. So here we go, and there's 5 points because that's my favorite number because I can count to it on one hand. So I'm gonna lead off, and the first thing is about incorporation bias. This can occur when the results of the test under study are actually used to make the final diagnosis. And remember, you hinted earlier in the study, the authors acknowledged that the physicians may have been aware of the D-dimer results when they were assessing the year's criteria. And this can make the test, the diagnostic algorithm in this case, appear more powerful by falsely raising both the sensitivity, which means true positives, and the specificity, which means true negatives.
All right, number two was partial verification bias or referral bias or workup bias. So this can happen when only a certain set of patients who underwent the index test is verified by the reference standard. In years, only those who had a positive D-dimer, so either over 1,000 or over 500, depending on their year's criteria.
Positive or negative,
got the definitive test. So this could increase the sensitivity but decrease the specificity.
So we're going through all these nerdy biases, and you need to know this when you're looking at some kind of test for diagnostic accuracy. And the third one was differential verification bias. This is called the double gold standard. And this is very similar to the partial verification bias and could be part of incorporation bias. Differential verification bias can occur when the test result that you get influences the choice of the reference standard. So a positive test, if you said they were years positive, then they got the immediate gold standard, right? They went off for a CT scan. Whereas if the patient was years
negative,
right? What did they get? 3 months of observation and follow-up. They didn't get the gold standard. So it's a double gold standard. And this can raise or lower the sensitivity and specificity.
So number four, subjectivity. So one of the weaknesses of this study is that it includes the subjective part of the Wells criteria as part of our year's criteria, the part where the clinician needs to use clinical gestalt and decide if a PE is the most likely diagnosis.
Yeah, and so that's one of the criticisms and limitations of the Wells criteria, and it's incorporated into the year's criteria because it depends on your clinical judgment. If you have great clinical judgment, right, like Teresa, it's okay, but if you don't have as good of clinical judgment, right, how accurate will that test be? The fifth thing is about spectrum bias. And, you know, you made me think of this sort of bias because sensitivity depends on the spectrum of disease. And while specificity depends on the spectrum of non-disease. So you could easily falsely raise the specificity if the year's algorithm is used as a screening test. So you could look, you know, because remember, specificity is true negative. So if you want to make a test look really, really good, screen everybody without the disease, right? Because if you're screening a population without the disease, the specificity looks really, really good. And so what we need to be careful about is just because you're pregnant, not anymore, but just because you were pregnant, right, and you had some vague shortness of breath and stuff like that, and it's tired at the end of the day and stuff, that doesn't mean you get into the year's algorithm and we start doing this thing and start ordering D-dimers on people, because you know that we're going to get a lot of false positives then. And the clinician in this test, in this study, had to be clear that they had a suspicion of a PE. So if you're not suspicious, don't go down that road. Don't go into the algorithm. And these biases that I'm talking about, the best paper on that was a paper by a friend of mine, Chris Carpenter, and the lead author was Kahn. Do you know where that's from?
I don't.
Who here knows where Kahn is from? Shout it out. Star Trek II, The Wrath of Khan.
There we go.
You've been out for 3 years?
Yep.
Yeah. So it's because she's half my age. Okay. All right. Well, now we need to comment on the author's conclusions and compare them to the SGEM's conclusions.
So we generally agree with the author's conclusions.
All right. Give us an SGEM bottom line.
So the Pregnancy Adapted Years algorithm has the potential to safely rule out PE and decrease CTPA studies, but requires external validation.
And can you resolve the case that you presented at the beginning?
So in terms of what I'll tell my patient?
No, this is the case resolution.
Okay.
But thanks for jumping ahead.
So
you're doing excellent. But isn't she doing a fantastic job, though? Yeah, you really are. I think there's going to be a second podcast.
We'll see for the follow-up. All right. So my clinical suspicion is that she does not have a VTE, and I do not want to work her up for a PE.
All right. So you used your clinical gestalt and said, I'm not going to go into that pathway, right?
That's right.
All right. How are you going to take this pregnancy-adapted years criteria, how are you going to take this study and apply it clinically?
So the data on the pregnancy-adapted years algorithm is encouraging, but again, should go through external validation prior to implementation clinically.
So now do you want to tell us what you're going to say? That
I'm going to tell my
patient.
Yeah,
you go ahead and say, this is what she's going to, and actually this is one of the best parts of the podcast, because we've just gone through 20 minutes of like dissecting and being really nerdy about the details and stuff like that. But how do you take that information, sit at the patient's bedside, and speak English, right? You know, and translate that high-end sort of critical appraisal into something that they can understand. So what would you say to them?
So I would tell her that based on my experience, I don't think that she has a blood clot in her lung. And I explained that the blood test that she's talking about is called a D-dimer. And while it's a good test for ruling out blood clots, it can be falsely elevated, especially in pregnancy. And this can actually lead to unnecessary CT scans with radiation that she is terrified about. I provide her some reassurance and tell her to come back to the emergency department if she gets increasingly short of breath or develops chest pain, starts to cough up blood, or one leg becomes swollen, or if she becomes worried.
I'm adding in here the Keener contest winner, and last week's winner was Mario Pinoli. This is a repeat win for Mario. He knew that Carl Dussek is credited with the first use of ultrasound as a diagnostic tool. Mario said, I do not need to send him another cool skeptical prize as long as I pronounce his name correctly. I hope I did. What's the question this week?
So, Peterborough has a junior A hockey team.
Oh no, I changed it. Didn't you know that?
I didn't know that.
I didn't. Okay, yeah, you go ahead and do the Junior A one. We'll have two Keener contests, okay?
All right.
You do that one and I'll do the second one.
Okay. Who is the most famous Peterborough Petes player to go on and have the most NHL success?
So I'm going to modify that because we may not get the right answer then, because we have to be really specific. So Peterborough has a Junior A hockey team, right? The Petes? Yeah. Okay. Who is the most famous Peterborough Pete? Which is different than saying, because that could include hockey players and other people involved in the organization.
Right.
Had arguably the most successful NHL career. So that's number one question. The second question I actually put it in is, we mentioned that with regards to a 25-year-old woman, so what is the estimated increased risk of breast cancer from a CTPA in a 25-year-old pregnant woman? So if you know the answer to this week's Keener contest, then email me at thesgem@gmail.com. The first correct answer will receive a cool skeptical prize. Well, thank you, Teresa, for coming on your first of, I hope, many podcasts on the SGEM.
Thanks, Ken.
And thank you to KEMC for listening. You have one final task, and that's because at the end of every podcast, I have a tagline, and that tagline is trying to emphasize skepticism and critical thinking and the whole idea of evidence-based medicine. We've presented the literature, mm-hmm. right? But then you said, how am I going to clinically interpret that using my clinical judgment? So you have the literature that informs our care, you have your clinical judgment, and then you have to ask the patient what they value and their preferences. And remember, she was terrified about the radiation exposure, so you've got to address that. And so this is the tagline at the end. And what I'm going to ask is that all of you together read the tagline as loud as you can so we can pick it up on our mics. So can you do that on the count of three? One, two, three. Remember to be skeptical of anything you learn, even if you heard it on the Skeptic's Guide to Emergency Medicine. Talk to everyone next week.
say.